Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today we'll dance, we'll sing She Loves Me, and revel in the fascinating world of typography. That's right, from humble hyphens to scintillating serifs. Typographer-poet Robert Bringhurst is our guide, and film scholar Mary Dalton takes us behind the scenes to the land of the mighty beignet. She'll share her take on the HBO series Tremé. Award-winning dancers, choreographers Kimberly Bartosik and Minglong Yang explore the many nuances of movement during University of North Carolina School of the Arts Fall Dance. Off-Broadway directing sensation G.T. Upchurch shares her craft and sings the praises of Joe Mastrov's romantic comedy She Loves Me. UNCSA's fourth-year drama students bring it to the Gerald Friedman Theater Performance Place. So put down your Kindle, pick up a good book, leaf through the pages, and we'll return to that wonderful corporeal world next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and today we'll be talking theater, film, and typography with some of the best in the business a little later on this hour. But first, let's dance. The annual Fall Dance Concerts continue this weekend at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. These gripping productions provide audiences with a glimpse into the highly professional training that goes on at the school. For the student dancers themselves, it's an opportunity to approach new works from both an academic and vocational perspective under the collaborative guidance of some of today's leading dancer choreographers. BESCIE award-winning performer, New York City-based choreographer, and UNCSA alumna Kimberly Bartosik was a longtime member of the legendary Merce Cunningham Dance Company. Her recent works, commissioned and presented by Dance Theater Workshop, New York Live Arts, and others, explore space, time, and audience perspective. Taiwan native and UNCSA School of Dance contemporary dance faculty Minglong Yang was founding member and artistic director of Dance Forum Taipei Dance Company, and his choreography has been presented around the world. Both artists will premiere new works performed by UNCSA dancers during Fall Dance. They spoke with me recently between rehearsals. To represent stability within the realm of choreography, what would be an image that you could throw my way that would...
Really simple, just having somebody standing still. Time is still passing, but the movement isn't over as soon as we see it. So you have time to take it in, and it sort of stabilizes space to have somebody to stand still. A lot of times as choreographers, we just want people to move all the time. And one thing that I do a lot is work on how different kinds of time can coexist. So the past can be present with the present moment, or ideas of something that we don't know yet, like something in the future existing with the present moment.
Both of you all have trained with, performed with these great companies. I wonder what studying with, you know, Martha Graham on one hand, and then doing work in Taiwan. What are there differences? Can you generalize in terms of approach to, you know, modern dance in America versus Taiwan?
In the past, usually teacher will hold a stick, and then coming to the States, teacher don't hold a stick, and just made me feel a little bit uncomfortable about that. Back then, when I was training in Taiwan, the only modern technique we have is Martha Graham. And then really, it's just I come to the States, really opened my eyes. I was like, oh, wow, okay. So yeah, modern dance could be so broad and so versatile. And it's completely different from what I can imagine. Mark Morris, he did a solo entitled Jealousy. And that, it just really blew my mind. It's like, okay, jealous, it's the kind of like emotion is really subtle. It's different from angry, right? To express anger on the stage is really easy. To express joy, happiness is really easy. But to express something like jealousy, this kind of like subtle, really subtle feeling, he did it so well. He did it just like from one fingertips and start to move like a worm. And then through the wrist, through the arm, and then through into space, and then go down to the floor, even the tiny toes are doing the same. And you say, that's exactly how people feel jealousy. We all tell ourselves not to be jealous. It's nothing to be jealous. You turn away, then you turn back. You saw that person, you saw that object. You said, right away, you go like, everything grows. It's like, that's exactly the kind of work I wanna make. I'm not interested in telling you the story because you know the story. and what can be best to understand the story, movie or drama, you can understand that better than dance. So use dance to tell a story is nothing I'm interested in. Like more like Kim, I'm also interested in more like conceptual ideas.
Yeah, you already know that story, but how does it feel? I mean, you're exploring a feeling in a sense.
Yes, exactly. So then I made a piece before just using Chinese traditional music, mm-hmm. and that instrument called guqin, and it's very simple. In the past, how the artists they played that instrument, there's no score, there's no note, and then the artists play that just one single note going ding, and leave a lot of room, time for listener to think the next note might be this. So often they got surprised from by the artist. It's oh my God, that sound is so beautiful. It's just like ding, 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 something like that. It's just, that completely also so free.
Let the brain fill in the blanks.
Exactly. And also create the kind of anticipation that you hear that, you kind of anticipate what might come next. But then the artist so often surprise you. And so I love that. So I spent almost 2 years make a movement phrase just based on, okay, what can surprise myself? So I went into the studio, I played the music, and I just keep dancing. And I'm interested in capturing the quality of that sound. It's very thin because you only use your finger to pluck the instrument. It's a string.
Is it just one string?
No, there are 6 or 8.
Give me the name of the instrument one more time.
Guqin.
Traditional Chinese instrument?
Yes, and it's really, really beautiful. And sound itself is really beautiful.
You know, Ming, a lot of the initiations of movement in this one choreography I'm looking at on YouTube, and it's just a 2-minute piece, you begin a lot of motions with non-traditional parts of the body, like suddenly the elbow's leading or the shoulder's leading or the hip is leading or the knee.
I'm always imagining that if I can do it with my finger, can I do it the same quality with my knee? Can I do it with the same quality by point my toes into the space? Or even sometimes I play with that as like, okay, if my ear can do the same thing too, or my nose can do the same, or the center of my heart, can it do the same feeling and same gesture? And so what you saw on the YouTube, that's exactly what I'm interested in playing with. I always play with things that can really surprise myself too. And I also encourage the dancers to surprise me and make mistake. Take the ownership to make mistake. Allow themselves to make mistake. And oftentimes, I found that mistake is more attractive than what I have.
Kimberly, it was interesting to hear Ming share how Martha Graham, in a sense, opened up your whole horizon. I mean, the possibilities. Was wondering about, I'm a fan of Merce Cunningham's and John Cage's music, and wondering, long-time association there, 19 original works with Merce Cunningham. First off, did you collaborate directly with him in those productions? And if so, what was that dynamic like?
Nobody collaborated with Merce. Merce had a very traditional, very separate relationship between him and his dancers, especially by the time I got there. I think his early years was a little bit more family-like. Uh-huh. But when I was there, we did not speak to Merce except maybe about the weather or his cats or something we ate. He was really interested in food, as was John. They were both very, very beautiful people, but extremely conservative in their relationships with us. Mm-hmm. And I feel that I owe my whole career to Merce, and I've also spent a good part of it, I wouldn't say rejecting him, but having to sort of get him out of my body and get him out of my body, see what else is there, and then work from that, and then slowly maybe bring ideas that I learned from him back in. It's really specific, being, I felt, being a woman dancing for Merce, because having a man completely crafting your body was a very strong influence for me. I was very, very young when I started working with him. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredibly nourishing experience for me. But when I left, I needed to understand what my body was as a female body and as a body that had to suddenly make choices about what I believed about dance. I wanted to take the radical other approach that Merce took. I wanted to ask how I could make something that wasn't only about the body, but where all the elements were completely interdependent. So in Merce's work, all the elements were independent of one another. We rehearsed in silence without music. We didn't hear the music till opening night. Curtain would go up. We would hear the sound when the audience heard the sound. And we didn't rehearse in costume or in lights or anything. Just everything came together on that night. And sometimes it was a wonderful, as we know, wonderful experiment. And sometimes it wasn't. But it was always very in the moment. Really wonderful. But with my own work, because I was really interested in research, physical research, intellectual research, connecting more to things happening in the world. Right now, I'm doing a lot of research on violence in our culture. And so these things take time. And I got to a point where the body was not enough for me. I needed to figure out how I could communicate my ideas. And what else was there for me to use? So I started thinking about design, and that's really where cinematic elements come in for me. I work a lot with light, and my work is very process-oriented now because I work with my designers. If I'm working with a sound designer, the sound designer is there from the beginning. If I'm working with a lighting designer, they're there from the beginning. The light is an integral part of the piece. It's not something that's put on during tech, so that all of the elements kind of are in conversation with each other, and the body is still the central element, but it needs those other things.
Well, tell me about your new work. And this is an accelerated process for you on this particular choreography, but a premiere, right?
It is a premiere.
Well, Kimberly, tell me about it.
There are such strong kernels of what I do with my professional work that have somehow come along through this process in a really kind of beautiful way, because I just didn't know that I was sort of translating my ideas about space or my ideas about time passing or my ideas about violence, that they weren't consciously coming through because I wasn't thinking that it was appropriate for this group. But they're such a phenomenally mature group of dancers that things have been filtering into them in very significant ways. And a couple people, when they've seen some rehearsals, they say, wow, this is a really adult piece. And I feel so proud of that, because I feel like somehow our worlds we've had this meeting. Like, I've brought my adult ideas about the world, and then they've grown up a lot in this process and have been so open to real exploration, I think, and to working without music and working, you know, I experiment with sound. I don't think of what I do as putting music on a piece. I experiment with sound. And so we have different sounds every day. I'm like, let's try this. Let's face that way. Let's do this way. And they just have been trying it. So it's been really very dynamic, barely finished.
Barely. Now I'm going to compare and contrast. I love the title, Lotto. You're building on the original. How does that work?
This actually, Lotto that I set here at UNCSA is the 60th version. And I have been working on this at different schools. How Lotto, this piece coming is, since we're going to collaborate and we don't know each other, and what would be the common subject or theme that we can play with? Then we came out with number is the universal language. 1 + 1, we all know that, equal 2. So now we have one company from Taipei plus the other company from London, and that equal 2. But is 2 only equal 1 + 1, or it could equal 1.1 plus 0.9 minus blah, 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 and time this, and then divide it into this. And so there are unlimited possibilities. So we see that, okay, yes. So let's play with number. So they have their way of generating movement by using number. They stick the number on the inner thigh. Like, for example, this is 3, the left side is 3, and the upper arm, this is 4. And so then they put the number on their body parts.
Physically drawing the number on their body parts.
Yes. And then pull out a phone number and say, okay, let's make a combination of this number with parts of our body moving. And that's how they come up with the movement material. And then we send each other movement through Skype, and it works. For my part, we are looking at, I don't want my dancers to mimic the shape of the number. I would like them to look beyond that. So what does the number 6 make you think of? What does number 9 make you think of? What about number 4? And is number 6 heavier than number 9? Or vice versa.
And could that depend on the day? Does it change in the performance from the rehearsal?
Yes. And also we look at the number beyond the quality or what it can make you think of. So meaning, for example, number 1. Who's the number 1 of the nation? President. Who's the number 1 of the company? CEO. What they have? Power. So we say, okay, now let's make a really powerful movement based on this idea. Great. And for example, like a number 4, for some people, they think of like sailboat. And so then they fly like a wing. And for some people, think about that, it's the foundation of a building, 4 corners. So it's very boxy, very heavy, very steady. And then they build a movement based on that idea instead of imitating number 4.
Now you're saying they build a movement. Are you empowering the dancers to come up with these things?
Yes. I had originally, I make a show phrase based on number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0. And I show them and I tell them that this is how I look at the number. And I would like you to make your own number.
How have the students responded to that? That's a lot of responsibility.
Oh, yes. Right now, especially that, I mean, Kimberly knows that a lot of contemporary choreographers, they collaborate with their dancers a lot. Yeah, right now, that how we make works, we don't usually generate movement only. We give idea. We hope that the dancers can, based on the idea, and show what they have. Because oftentimes, I found that if I keep asking them to do exactly what I like them to do, they are not me. They can never be exactly what I like them to do. So I have to leave room for them to show themselves. And once they are confident to show themselves, everything's beautiful.
Bessie, award-winning performer, New York City-based choreographer, and University of North Carolina School of the Arts alumna Kimberly Bartosik, and UNCSA School of Dance Contemporary Dance faculty Ming Lung Yang. Their new works, along with that of Associate Dean Brenda Daniels, are being performed during UNCSA's Fall Dance Concert through Saturday, November 23rd, with an evening performance Friday, November 22nd at 7:30, and a Saturday matinee at 2 in the Agnes DeMille Theater on the UNCSA campus. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time to step off the dance floor now and go behind the scenes with guest commentator, Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton. Mary's also co-director of the documentary film program at Wake. You can check out her media blog on our website, wfddalton.wordpress.com.
I never actually paid for HBO until a couple of years ago because I could binge watch all of the shows I wanted to watch on DVD. And then there was this moment where I saw a preview for a show called Tremé. And that in and of itself was not enough to make me fork over the money every month. But learning that David Simon was one of the creators of Tremé got me on board because I was such a fan of The Wire. And I'm now really excited about December 1st. because that's when, for a short season, Treme will come back on HBO. After 3 seasons on the air, we're going to get 5 more episodes. The show's about New Orleans. If you know the word Treme, that's a neighborhood. It's a district in New Orleans. And the city is really the star of the show. But the music is the lifeblood of the show. I'm going to share a little scene, and in this scene, 2 characters, Annie and Harley, played by musicians Lucia Macchiarelli and Steve Earle, are talking about Annie's career, sitting by the riverbank as the water flows by.
You didn't tell me about what it was like playing with Sean Colvin. How'd that happen?
She saw me on Frenchman Street. She asked me to come down to soundcheck, and we worked up a song.
Very cool.
At the end of the set, she introduced me to her manager, a dude from Austin.
Austin, huh?
Like, he's gonna sign me right up because Sean tells him so.
No interest?
No. I gotta sing, I know.
Not just sing. If you wanna reach for a brass ring, you gotta write.
The show's not just about music, though. Treme starts post-Katrina. And that's part of the vibrancy of the series for me, because it's contrasting in its emotional tones. It's both chaotic and lethargic. It's chaotic because the city has seen the infrastructure totally broken down by the storm. And it's lethargic because that's just sort of the way New Orleans is, the southern lifestyle. Even in the winter, there's a slower pace in the south than in a lot of other places. Some people think that's not great. There were criticisms of the show early on about pacing. In the era of slow television, some people thought this was a little too slow. But that's one of the things I love about it, because as the seasons progress, as the city starts to rebuild, then the show does pick up a little bit in terms of the complexity of the narratives. The show really mirrors what was happening in the city at those times. And in addition to music, the city has other key elements, defining elements, food, politics, police scandals, history, and all of these elements are embedded into the series in a wonderful, organic way. One of the things I love about it is how complex the show is, dealing with all these institutions, just like The Wire. But the thing about The Wire is that was Baltimore. Baltimore has a totally different mood, a totally different tone, a totally different pace from New Orleans. And the pace for Treme and the mood and the tone fit that city. Since all of the previous seasons are available on DVD, Treme is perfect for binge viewing between now and December 1st, and then you can catch up and watch the final 5 episodes at the same time I do.
Behind the Scenes with Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton. You can check out Mary's media blog on our website, wfddalton.wordpress.com. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break right now. When we return, it's time to talk typography, the art and technique of arranging type to bring out the language, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Renowned typographer Robert Bringhurst is also a linguist, translator, cultural historian, and one of Canada's most revered poets. His poetry has been described as rare but not rarefied. And in his landmark book, The Elements of Typographic Style, he's been said to, quote, conjure poetry out of the smallest detail, from the humble hyphen to the nuances of serifs. Robert recently lectured in Haynes Gallery on the Wake Forest University campus as part of the gallery's ongoing exhibition, Letter Forming. His lecture was titled The Biology of Symbols, How Pictures Became Letters That Became Text and Are Sometimes Becoming Pictures Again. Prior to his lecture, Robert spoke with me by phone from his home in British Columbia.
Most people who study the history of writing find a lot of things to argue about, but one of the hardest things to argue about is the thesis that writing grew out of drawing. Most people who are interested in this subject agree that that must be where writing came from, that letters are the abstract descendants of pictures. But there's a funny thing that goes on in writing, which is that people seem to have an almost irresistible urge to try to turn them back into pictures. You must have seen books from the Victorian age in which, or children's books from the present age in which maybe the letters on the title page to turn into pictures, you know, or they're made out of pictures. And this doesn't make reading easier. It's a distraction. But for some reason, it seems to be an irresistible impulse in people. So there's some indication there that writing and drawing are not as completely separated as the purists might like them to be. And now we have new tools for writing and drawing as well, in which it's easier than ever to blur or even erase the boundary between letters and drawing. I mean, your computer makes it easy for you to turn the digital image of a letter into an outline, which you can then play with as if it were a picture. You don't have to have any graphic skill anymore. The machine will do all kinds of tricks for you. So this old impulse to jump back and forth between the world of pictures and the world of abstract symbols, letter forms, new opportunities laid out before it.
Is that how you see it from your stance? I mean, I'm reading a quote here that I believe this is something you'd mentioned in terms of your own relationship to poetry. Poetry spoken to be written and written to be spoken. I'm wondering what's lost in all this blurring of those lines with new technologies and, or is there?
Well, if you're really going to read something, you really need to read it and not look at it as a picture, right? There are two different processes. Different things happen in the brain when you read a text and when you look at a picture. But pictures very often form in your mind when you hear a story or tell a story. In the storytelling world, one of the ways to really praise a good storyteller is to say, you know, that person can really see what she's telling. Storytellers sometimes say they have a kind of movie running in their heads, and when they tell the story, they're just trying to keep up with the scenes that unfold in their minds. But those scenes don't get on the paper or the computer screen, right? They're translated into language, which for most of us is something spoken. And that's the way the letters of our alphabet work. They represent sounds. They do this in a strangely inconsistent and complicated and unnecessarily complicated way, but they represent sounds, and so when we see the words on the page, we can form the sounds again. This has nothing to do with pictures, but it's very often in the service of pictures. And in some writing systems, Chinese, for example, there's still some pictorial residue left in the characters. I mean, people don't read them as pictures. They wouldn't be reading if they did. But if you come to this as an outsider, you can find the pictorial elements, which are very hard to find in the Latin alphabet. For me, these things are quite separate the most of the time. Sounds are sounds and pictures are pictures, and I'm happy for them to stay in their separate domains, but things do sometimes move around.
Hey, what was your initial draw to Native American myths and storytelling?
You know, I live in America, and so in North America, and so I want to know where I live, and that's an essential part of where I live. I've been in contact with Native people all my life and learned a great deal from them. And when I got serious about literature, you know, I started to wonder why it is that, you know, the literary history that I'm learning, the old books I'm reading, all come from other places, from Europe or from Asia. What about the stuff from here? There's plenty of stuff from here. The literary people tend to ignore it, even though it has tremendous literary value.
In one of your many books, The Solid Form of Language, dealing with the history of script in a more general way than was dealt with in the elements of typographic style, it seems like just a huge topic to be able to lay out in what appears to be a really relatively small book. Could you kind of share what interests you most in this broad topic and what the challenges were in laying it out in that format?
It's always a challenge to put something big into a small space. But I very often found it a rewarding challenge. You know, once in a while, people ask me to write encyclopedia entries on some subject that I might know something about. And you know, if you've written a 500-page book about Native American literature and then somebody asks you to write an encyclopedia entry on this subject that has to be limited to 1,000 words, what are you going to do? Well, it's been my experience over and over again doing a job like that, that actually by writing the really short, super condensed version, I learned things that I didn't learn by writing the long version. I mean, you have to make generalizations, and you have to condense the facts and draw the outlines, you know, so maybe it's something like a simple outline drawing of a figure as opposed to making a really elaborate, fully textured and colored painting. You can build up the painting by thousands and thousands of little brushstrokes and maybe never learn some of the interesting facts about the outline. But if you draw the outline in three or four pencil strokes, for all the things you leave out, there are some things that you have to put in, and you find out exactly what those things are. What exactly is the shape of this nose, or what exactly is the shape of that ear, or whatever it is you're drawing. Writing the minimalist account of something forces you, again, to sort of stand back from the shape and say, well, you know, exactly what shape is it? What exactly are the most important features here, and what can I leave out?
Well, let's go in the opposite direction just briefly. Roy Johnson wrote, with reference to elements of typographic style, that you can, and I'm quoting here, conjure poetry out of the smallest details, the humble hyphen, to nuances of serifs. And I wonder if you could give us one of those examples, getting into the minutiae of this science, this art.
You know, the hyphen on a typewriter is almost always just a simple line chopped off at either end. You magnify it, you have a thin rectangle. But if you make a hyphen with a good pen, a broad nib pen, a calligrapher's pen, it'll have a much more elaborate shape than that. It'll have maybe a little entry serif, a little exit serif. It'll be tapered a little bit or sloped a little bit or angled a little bit. And those things can be introduced into a type design, or they can be left out. The world is now awash in type designs, right? There are tens of thousands of them available to everybody. You can download them by the hundreds to your computer for almost nothing. And most of them are deadly boring because they're just cookie-cutter shapes. But some of them are made individually by hand by somebody who's in love with the shapes and enjoys making them and therefore makes them beautifully.
Lots is lost without those sorts of connections today. You alluded to a couple. Are there opportunities there that you see as well?
The tools we have are lovely, and they're fast, and they'll do all kinds of nice things. But the problem is we're almost always working in two dimensions with transitory flat images. Real type, like real life, is three-dimensional. It's got body. It's got weight. You can hold it in your hand, and it weighs something. And the letter forms are driven into the paper instead of just painted on the surface. And then, you know, reading is different in the letterpress world than it is in the flat world. Like walking in the woods is different from looking at a photograph of the woods. So the price we paid for the incredible speed and manipulative ease of modern digital tools is that we've lost a lot of contact with that corporeal world, and I think we're going to have to find our way back there.
The corporeal world, I like that. It reminded me of the image of the cover, at least. And again, I'm looking at this on, unfortunately, a computer screen, but the cover of The Solid Form of Language. It just looks beautiful. It looks so, I want to touch that that handmade paper, and the letters and symbols on the cover seem three-dimensional in a sense.
They are three-dimensional. That cover is printed letterpress. The book inside, for financial reasons, is printed on an offset press, so those letters are perfectly flat, but the ones on the cover are printed in a real press from real type on real, as you say, handmade paper, and boy, it does make a difference. It really does. If you think it's nice on your computer screen, you should get the real thing in your hands, because then you see, you don't just see it with your eyes, you see it with your fingertips as well. And you do both of these things at the same time, and your fingers tell things to your eyes, and your eyes tell things to your fingers, and your whole body gets involved in the process. It really does make a difference. It makes ideas more real, more tangible, it makes them less fugitive. They don't disappear from your head so easily if you actually had them in your hands.
In letter forming, this exhibition going on here at Wake Forest, Paul Bright mentions it. It highlights historical moments of ferment when the confluence of various forces resulted in radically diverse approaches to the problem of conveying ideas and information through writing and across cultures. How do you view this, you know, moment of ferment in society today? And I guess we could expand it globally with regard to some of the things we've talked about already with today's graphic design and innovation and the use of computers. Where are we?
Well, we're everywhere at once, which is a pretty bad place to be, actually. They may tell you when you're growing up that you can have everything if you work hard enough, but it isn't true. You can't have everything. Mm. And if you deceive yourself into thinking that you have it, you haven't understood life very well. I think that it's obvious to most people that this railroad train called progress can't keep running faster every year and farther every year without end. And right now, it's pretty close to running out of control and ruining the planet where we live in the process, from extracting too much fossil fuel, burning too much fossil fuel, building too many things, paving too much, cutting down too many forests, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this may appear to have nothing to do with graphic design, but graphic design is part of the mess. It's dragged into the tumult because it doesn't have a choice. Everything in our lives is touched by this mania for more, this attempt to have everything at once, to burn all the fuel there is and buy all the goods that there are. So I think this is not something that we will keep doing for very much longer, because we can't. I think that it's a ferment, all right, but the end result is going to be a big vat of vinegar rather than wine.
Typographer, poet, Robert Bringhurst. He spoke with me by phone from his home in British Columbia. Last week, Robert visited the campus of Wake Forest University, where he gave a lecture titled The Biology of Symbols, How Pictures Became Letters That Became Text and Are Sometimes Becoming Pictures Again. There was a Q&A as well, followed by a post-lecture reception and exhibition opening at Haynes Gallery in the Scales Fine Arts Center on the Wake Forest University campus. It was part of the ongoing exhibition, Letter Forming, which will remain on display through December 8th. The exhibit is free and open to the public, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short intermission. When we return, it's back to letters, but of a very different sort. Imagine falling in love with your pen pal, only to find out that your pal is actually an office mate that you just can't stand. I know, in this age of Facebook, caller ID, and selfies, it's tough to picture today, but that's where the magic of theater comes in. The delightful romantic comedy She Loves Me comes to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and director and UNCSA alumna G.T. Upchurch is here to sing its praises next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Wake Forest University and University of North Carolina School of the Arts alumna G.T. Upchurch may have just graduated from UNCSA School of Drama in 2005, but she's already on lots of people's radar. G.T. has directed several off-Broadway productions, including last year's Harper Reagan by Simon Stevens, which received a Top 10 Shows of 2012 nod from the New York Times. The Times also profiled G.T. in February's article, Staging a Sisterhood, about the rise of women directors in New York. Recently, G.T.'s been sharing her talents with UNCSA fourth-year senior drama students during rehearsals for Joe Mastaroff's romantic comedy, She Loves Me.
Going to see, be the girl that he's imagined me to be.
Where did you grow up, first off?
I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay, so from Mississippi to, was it first Wake Forest and then
first
UNCSA?
First Wake Forest.
Wake Forest University, where you majored in English?
Yes.
English. Then on to UNCSA, then North Carolina School of the Arts.
That's right. And in between, I taught 7th grade English at the Summit School.
Summit School.
Yes.
A very fine school there on Rinalda Road.
It
so
is.
Welcome back. And what's
Thank
it like
you.
Being back in the Piedmont Triad?
I've always loved it here. I spent about 10 years of my life in Winston-Salem, and it's such a treat to be back. It's such a great community. It's an easy place to live. Mm-hmm. And I've been living downtown, and I've literally on the street run into so many people that I've known over the years. And so reconnecting with old friends and seeing some of my professors and being back on campus at School of the Arts, that has been amazing.
You were teaching at Summit School when you met Gerald Freeman.
Yes.
Legendary producer director. From there, obviously, impact? I mean, you just decided to go or pursue theater
as a
career. What about that interaction with where Gerald kind of got the gears turning in that direction?
Well, I went over to North Carolina School of the Arts seeking information about the drama program. And I had been in a small dance company in Winston-Salem, and I was teaching school at the same time. And I stopped dancing. And shortly after that, I started to feel like I was really missing the performing arts in my life. And I had a cousin who was over at North Carolina School of the Arts as a stage manager. Oh. So I went over there and started seeing some of their shows. And they were amazing. And I don't know that I'd ever had that experience with theater, with a straight play before. I mean, certainly I'd seen a lot of live performances, but it was usually dance. So that was life-changing in a way. When I spoke to Gerald, I was interested in acting at first because it seemed to me that that was sort of the way to get involved in theater. And Gerald said to me, you know, with your background and the fact that you're, you know, not 18 to start this program, you should really think about directing. And so he let me come and observe some of his directing classes. And I thought they were amazing. And I ended up applying to go to the school, and Gerald took me into the directing program.
In that class, seeing his interaction with the students, what hit you at a gut level?
Well, for Gerald's directing classes, it's Gerald sitting at a table with however many directing students there were. I think of the classes I was observing, there were four. And it was a conversation about all different kinds of art. And Gerald has a painting background, actually, and I took a lot of painting classes at Wake Forest, and it was a love of mine that I'd never really got to explore. And there was something about the way that theater, to me, listening to people talk about it in that room, was a synthesis of the visual arts, the performing arts, choreography, dance, and literature. And I'd been an English major at Wake Forest and was teaching 7th grade English, so it seemed to me to be an art form that would draw on all of my interests, and that's wound up to be true.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You kind of answered my next question, which is, you know, drawing from these various experiences, how does it come into the fore in your directing? But that's it. I mean, it's a little bit of everything.
It is. And every show that you work on is different and requires different amounts of research on different, you know, either parts of history or different ways of telling a story aesthetically. And so it's always exciting. It's always different.
I'm wondering, from those various disciplines, if there are a couple of touchstones that you frequently go back to from that time in your life or from those disciplines that you use in your daily directorial work in New York, say, for example. Are there some nuts and bolts stuff that you took from that experience?
Well, it's funny. I originally didn't think of my dance background as being a huge influence, but other people started to notice that. So I really started to think about, well, what is it about my dance background that's showing up on stage? And I think a lot of it has to do with, I really trust bodies in space. So I think there's something that can be just profoundly moving about a person with intention standing on a stage. And so I'm not hard-pressed to necessarily get to the next line of text. I think that as long as a person is telling a story and is in that moment, that we're with them. I think there's an exchange that happens between an actor or performer and the audience that you can trust implicitly. And so I think there's something about approaching the work in the word that's coming to mind is simple. I'm not sure if that's exactly what I mean, but stripped down, I guess, trusting just a human form in space to be inspiring and interesting in its own right without having to put a lot of bells and whistles on it.
So, I mean, it's hard to believe that, because I was just reading about you in the New York Times. I mean, and you're just emerging from this program 8 years ago. And I should point out this New York Times article featuring women directors up and coming, which I guess there's so many now, really good ones. Is there, do you feel a connection to some sort of movement or, you know, is there, do you keep in touch with women directors?
I do, particularly through the Women's Project, which is an off-Broadway theater in New York. And they have something called the Women's Project Lab, in which they take in a number of directors, playwrights, and producers every couple of years. And it's basically a forum for making connections and meeting women that are doing what you're doing. And that's been invaluable to me. I met a lot of collaborators that I work with out of that group. I'm proud of how many women there are directing off-Broadway now, and it's a great group to be a part of, and some of the most exciting work of the last year that I saw were helmed by women. So it is nice to not feel like you're an anomaly anymore. I do think that's less true when you look at Broadway, just numbers-wise. There are very few women who are directing at that level, but hopefully that's changing too.
How I wish that we could meet another day. It's absurd for me to carry on this.
Let's get into She Loves Me. Let's talk She Loves Me. I didn't realize this is your first full-scale musical.
It is, yes.
What challenges, rewards along those lines?
I just got to hear the orchestra in rehearsal for the first time yesterday, and I got teary, I have to say, just being in a room and hearing this 15-piece orchestra playing the music that we've been working on for 6 weeks. And I'm really looking forward to getting to the theater and hearing them up there. And our actors were there at the rehearsal and got to sing their solos with the orchestra. And that's exciting to me. I used to work with live musicians in a lot of my plays. And then that gets a little more difficult production-wise. I think it's a huge cost. So to be somewhere where I can work with a hired orchestra is amazing.
Yeah, that UNCSA does not go halfway with any of their productions.
And no, it's true.
Yeah, Carl Forsman was just talking about the beauty of being in an academic scenario and being able to keep some of these productions alive, like Street Scene, where you've got 44 different acting roles. It's just not done.
I mean,
he was saying it would be like $5 million to produce that today
off
Broadway. Well, that must be funny because they'll be down in the pit. Or is there a pit there?
There is, but we're actually, our set design has put them on a platform, so they're featured. You can see them throughout the show.
Oh, nice. Great.
Yeah.
It's a romantic comedy musical. How is it defined?
You know, one of the things that I really love about this particular show is that it's very quotidian in a way. It's not about an orphan looking for a home or a, you know, baron looking for a mother for his 8 children. It's very simple. It's about shop clerks looking for love, and they're in the middle of a depression, which you can, if you pay close attention to what they're saying, you can glean that. But it's very much a Valentine of a musical written at a time when people needed an escape. And it's so much fun for that. So it's a romantic comedy.
And a third incarnation of sorts.
Right. It was based on a play by Miklos Laszlo, who's a Hungarian playwright, and he wrote it in the mid-30s. And the name of that play is Parfumery. Then from there, The Shop Around the Corner, which was a Jimmy Stewart, Margaret Sullivan film made in 1940, is the same story based on that play. And then there's a Judy Garland musical called In the Good Old Summertime, which is different music and slightly different story, but all based still on Parfumery. And then She Loves Me in 1963. And then You've Got Mail as an updated film version.
I mean, all that to say, like a good folk tune that's built on and built on. I mean, it's got to be good. And this is it's one of those synopses you read 2 sentences, you go, oh, that would be a great idea for a play.
Yes, it holds up for sure.
It sure does.
I didn't like her. I didn't like her. I couldn't stand her. I couldn't stand her. I wouldn't have her. I never knew her. But now I do.
They say that comedy, though, or those sorts of interactions are very difficult for actors, period. But working with young actors at UNCSA, how's it been going?
First of all, they are hugely, wildly talented. So much so that was what I was floored by when I first got back to school. And I knew that. I went to school here and I worked with amazing actors here. But being away for 8 years and coming back and being that much older and seeing these students who are just extraordinary. And comedy it's very technical. And we have had to work on that part of it. I think working on comedies is sometimes notorious for being not very fun because of that reason. But because this is a musical, we've actually had a blast. But we did talk a lot about comedy techniques, and there are certain technical things that you need to do in order to get the laugh or to land the joke.
They say it's all about timing. But beyond that, though, what are some specifics from the director's chair? How do you coax that out of an actor or steer them in the right direction?
Well, strangely, one of the things is getting to the end of the line and lifting the last word.
Lifting
the last word just slightly so that it's a rhythmical thing. And one of the ways that we worked on that was a Gerald Friedman technique, which is you throw a beanbag back and forth at the end of the line to each other, and it gets you from being too naturalistic and sort of going into yourself, because the thing about a joke is it has to go out to the audience. And it was a way to bridge the gap between the actors feeling, if I do it this way, does it make me a phony? And it doesn't if you've incorporated it somehow into the process. And so we spent a lot of time working on comedy techniques and then integrating them into the scene so that they wouldn't lose the heart of the scene and the emotional truth of the scene.
Emotional truth, that's another... See, you're getting wonky on me. I love it. But this idea, you throw the beanbag just as you're about to utter the punchline of the last
word. That's
right. Yeah. How about that? So, and that gets you to deliver it to the audience in a way that you wouldn't otherwise.
It does. Or really to your scene partner in a way that you wouldn't otherwise. Because sometimes in a play, the reason people talk at all is they want something from the other person or they want to be heard by the other person. And we forget that sometimes in just trying to get the text out. And so throwing the beanbag is a way of reminding you who you're talking to and that you really want something from them. And it's helpful.
I've read the synopsis, I've read the different acts, you know, just kind of summaries, and I'm just saying, God, what a charming story. But what grabs you most about She Loves Me? Why would you want to do this particular musical?
One of the things I love about it is its vulnerability. The two leads are in love with each other but don't know it, and because in real life they sort of bicker, but they're in love with each other as pen pals. And there is a moment when they're about to meet face-to-face for the first time, and they each get to talk to their friends on stage to say what they're scared of. And it's such a raw moment, and I think it's something that everybody can relate to. And Amalia, the leading woman, has a solo called Will He Like Me, in which she just bares herself to say that she's scared, that this love affair that she started on letters is all going to fall apart when he meets her in person, because she's not going to hold up to being the woman that she wants him to see. And it's wildly vulnerable. And so in the middle of this, you know, big romantic comedy musical, you have just these gorgeous nuggets of pure, raw vulnerability and people being scared, just like we all are, you know, before meeting somebody that you care about.
Will he like me? I don't know. All I know is that I'm tempted not to.
Off-Broadway director, UNCSA alumna, class of 2005, and educator G.T. Upchurch. She Loves Me will run through November 24th with evening shows at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 2 in the Gerald Friedman Theater Performance Place on the UNCSA campus. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Kirsten Bowman. Hey, you know, we've got a couple of special editions of Triad Arts Weekend coming up called Triad Holiday Celebration. And as always, I'd like to make it a special event for our local musicians, authors, actors, and of course, WFDD listeners. For Triad musicians, please email me an MP3 of your best holiday performances. The address is triadarts@wfu.edu. And Triad writers and actors can send me an MP3 of your winter holiday poem, short story, or dramatic reading. Keep it 5 minutes or less in length, if you would, and I'll consider including it in the broadcast, too. The music or reading can be from any part of the world, but it must relate to the holiday season. Oh, and I need to receive your MP3s by midnight on December 9th. Again, that email address is triadarts@wfu.edu, and I look forward to hearing your holiday finest. You'll find podcasts of this program and archived episodes at wfdd.org. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.